Okay, I was asked to talk broadly about agent selection, about selecting biocontrol agents that are most likely to be effective. It's hopefully you're not expecting some sort of magic solution to picking the silver bullet, because that's proven to be a bit difficult in the past. But what I hope to achieve is provide a framework for helping us at least select the most effective agent as early as possible in a biocontrol program, and secondly, to know when to call a halt to a biocontrol program when there's no more effective agents out there. And that's often a very difficult decision to make when you're close to the program. So why should we bother about agent selection? Why should we focus on that? Well, there's a number of reasons. Of course, it's every agent is expensive to produce, so or to process and get through the regulatory system. So if we can at least select the most effective agent early, then that provides a lot of cost and resource savings. So just as an example, the prickly pear example, these are of course famous photos from southeast Queensland near where I live. In the 1930s, I think they were taken. Now with prickly pear, it's really held up as one of the best examples of successful biocontrol. But what many people don't realise, it actually took an enormous amount of resources. There was 150 insects identified in the native range. 52 species were actually host tested. That's a lot of species. 21 were released. And of the four that are considered to cause impact, the first, third, 11th and 17th agent were actually effective. And the one that was really the killer was Cactoblastis cactorum, and that was number 11. So if we look at that program in hindsight, they did a really good job in getting the first and third agent out that caused impact, but ideally we'd probably want to bring Cactoblastis cactorum in much earlier in the program and then call it quits. The second reason why it's important to concentrate on agent selection, of course, is to minimise the risk of unintended consequences, and we know about that. Probably the third reason is this credibility issue. As a discipline, I think it's important that we're continually showing that we're developing the science of our discipline. So there's this agent selection has of course had a lot of attention paid to it, probably right from the start of biocontrol, history of biocontrol. There's been a number of broad approaches that people have taken to try and select effective agents. Probably the most common is rules of thumb, and there's pages and pages of rules of thumb that's in the literature and in people's heads that they use to make these sorts of decisions. Some of the rules of thumb are very effective and proven through time, but most of them are actually prone to counter-argument and remain untested. And so therefore they risk abandoning effective agents. There was also a couple of attempts at developing a scoring system, and this is quite a neat idea if it works. Harris developed the first one that was modified by others. It certainly generated a lot of discussion in the biocontrol community, so from that point of view I think it was probably a very good thing to have tried, but in the end it proved to be a gross oversimplification to be able to come up with a scoring system that will somehow percolate out the most effective agents. And then there's been a range of approaches that uses more quantitative means, like modelling, both conceptual modelling and quantitative modelling, to help identify effective agents. So the approach I'm taking here is going to be slightly different from those, although of course it draws from some of those approaches. It's really deconstructing the question of agent selections into a number of components, and I'll talk about that shortly. It aims for progressive improvements in the way that we make predictions. It's a very plant-focused approach, and often we've taken an insect-focused approach because our backgrounds are entomology. It's an empirical data-driven approach, and it's a hypothesis-driven approach. So the basic framework, and this is what I'll talk about each of these in turn. The first is defining what the success criteria are of the total biocontrol program. So what are we actually trying to achieve by conducting biocontrol? Second is what potential agents are available and what do we need to know about them, and John Goolsbee presented a lot on that. Thirdly, what type, timing and degree of damage is required to actually achieve the necessary control to achieve the success that we're after. And finally, which agent of the ones available will reach the right density at the right time to exert the required damage. So in talking about each of these four, I'll draw on examples from my work on Parkinsonia aculeata. This is a species from the Neotropics that has become highly invasive in Australia. I think it's also known as Palo Verde in some places here. I could equally well have drawn from examples from a lot of other people's research, but I'll talk about this one. Parkinsonia aculeata is a particularly interesting one from my perspective because it's got such a wide ecological range in Australia. So it's invasive in the arid interior right up to the wet dry tropics, and it occurs across a lot of different habitat types as well. So the first step, success criteria, what are we trying to achieve? From the point of view of biocontrol, Parkinsonia in Australia is an invasive to, is causing impact both to production and to environment. I've jumped the gun here. More generally, in defining success criteria, there's a number of different levels that can be considered. So for example, we could think about impact on individual plants. And that might be important, for example, if we've got vines that are causing impact by smothering trees. And perhaps for an effective biocontrol program, all we really need to do is stop those vines from climbing trees. We don't actually have to kill the plants. There might be population level effects that really help us to achieve the success that we're after. So often, if we can somehow reduce the dominance of a plant species, of a weed species, then that's success. But sometimes it's not really the weed that's the problem, it's the weed within the context of the community. So what we're really trying to achieve is altering the pattern of species diversity in communities through changed succession, for example, and thereby allow us to restore communities. And finally, it might be more about the ecological processes that weed is impacting upon. So for example, a woody weed might be disrupting hydrological flows. So if we can somehow impact that weed population in a way that will restore those hydrological flows, then that's success. When we're developing success criteria, of course, a natural question to ask is biocontrol actually the best option? Can biocontrol actually lead us to success in the way that we're defining it? So in the case of Parkinsonia causes impact both to the environment and also to production. So the performance criteria or the success criteria that we're looking at for Parkinsonia in Australia is different depending on what context you're looking at. So the ecological objective is to reduce patch size and density. But for the production industry, it's only the large patches that are a problem for production. So if somehow we can reduce the patch size down to less than 0.1 of a hectare, then that would be considered to be successful. It's a slightly different situation in the environment where really we're just trying to reduce the dominance across the whole landscape. In terms of geographic objective, there's two regions where it's particularly important in the pastoral production sector, and there's three regions where we're really wanting to manage the weed successfully for the environment. And then there's also the management objective. There's a lot of money going into mechanical chemical control of Parkinsonia. So we would consider success if we could somehow reduce the growth, regrowth and recruitment by 50% of Parkinsonia and increase the time of reproduction by at least 1 year. So we've got our success criteria. For that particular weed, what agents are available? What's the full list of species that we can potentially select from? And there's numerous options for developing the way that we go about coming up with this list and detailing those species. And John's talk was mainly about this section. I'll just pick up on a few developments in our research on Parkinsonia, a few approaches that we're taking. So Parkinsonia culiata has got a very wide distribution. It goes from South America, Central America, up into southern United States. And the approach we've taken is to develop a climax model. It's a basic climate model for the Americas, for the native range, to identify habitats across that whole distribution where we might expect Parkinsonia to do particularly well. And they're the areas that we'll be focusing, or we have been focusing our searches for potential agents. A second aspect is the genetic structure of the species across the range. And as it turns out, there's actually three distinct genotypes. And the South American genotype is actually radiated from the Central and Northern American genotypes about 10 million years ago. So they're quite an ancient divergence. The number two genotype is the one that we've actually got in Australia. It's from Venezuela, we believe. But our native range structuring is really across those three genotypes to make sure that we've got it all covered. And finally, there's the biogeographic perspective that we can overlay on that. This is an insect biogeographic provinces that have been detailed in the literature, and we'd expect that there may be different diversity in each of these different provinces, so that's something we're testing as well. One of the issues in biocontrol, of course, when you're doing these native range surveying is that there's this taxonomic impediment, and it's probably stronger in the tropics than it is in the temperate regions. It's not uncommon for our programs to have 80 or so percent of the species that we're identifying or finding in the native range surveys not to be described or not to be identified. So this is an approach where we're testing is using mini barcodes, which is just a small fragment of DNA. And from the literature, it suggests that that up to 90% of species can be identified using mini barcodes. And one of the advantages we found with using mini barcodes is that you can often salvage small fragments of DNA from bin specimens. So as an example, this is just a species of brucids that's widely distributed in Central America. And we're testing, first of all, whether individuals taken from different hosts are different genotypes or not. And it appears as though there's only a single genotype that's across the different hosts. So there's mesquite and Parkinsonia. We're also testing whether different biogeographic regions might have different genotypes of brucids. And in this case, it does appear like there's a genotype from the Veracruz region and a genotype from the western coast of Mexico. And we're continuing that work, another one from Guatemala. So this gives us information about brucids. It also gives us some expectations about how other species might be structured across the Americas. So, okay, we know what we need to do to achieve success. We know the agents that are available that we can potentially select from. A third question is what damage is actually required for an effective biocontrol program? And it really is a very plant-focused question. And it's a question about what type of damage is required to cause that sort of the success that we're after, and what timing and dose response do we expect is required to cause that damage. There's a number of approaches people have taken. There's a plant demography approach, which is basically looking for Achilles' heels in the plant's life cycle. And there's a whole host of different approaches people have taken into using conceptual models and a range of more quantitative modelling approaches. There's also a lot of experimental approaches that people have taken, including plant responses to herbivory. So some of them is looking at learning from experience from agents that have already been released, and some of them are more experimental approaches using simulated herbivory trials, etc. In this presentation, I'll just be talking about the plant demography side of things. This is just one example for Parkinsonia, and it's the classic matrix model developed for the population. And this is just using field data in Australia, from Central Australia over a couple of years, measuring the transitions between the different life stages. And so this is the life cycle and the stage transition probabilities here derived from field data. And this is the sensitivity analysis to identify which steps in the life cycle is the plant likely to be most sensitive to. And we can see that killing adult large trees is the population is particularly vulnerable if you were to kill large trees. Germination, seed germination rate is also quite sensitive to, and also the growth going from each step in the life cycle is quite sensitive to. But this is using data just from one region, from one climatic region. What we're doing now is to use the data that we've collected across all the different climate zones and habitats to see whether the same drivers are happening consistently across the species or whether it's habitat and climate specific. A second piece of work we're doing is a bit more theoretical, and it's we've developed a simulation model, and it's really to look at what drives plant invasions, what determines invasion rates as a plant invades through a landscape. And we've looked at three different elements, landscape structure. So we've got the green is suitable habitat and the white is unsuitable habitat. We've got different fractions of habitat suitability in the landscape and different structures in the landscape. We have got dispersal dispersal patterns of the invasive plant species. So with these two parameters, we can describe the whole range of different dispersal curves that you might expect for an invasive plant. Then we've got the demography of the plant species. So a whole range of different life history types, so from annual to long-lived, varying the maturity, time to maturity of the plant species, the fecundity, seed banks, germination probabilities, etc. So what we're interested in here is what's the relative importance of each of these aspects for determining invasion rates. And from the point of view of biocontrol, of course, is there particular aspects that might be impacted by biocontrol, which this system will be particularly sensitive to. 2 minutes. Crikey. So this is the take-home point here is that we've got annual to long-lived plants, and different life history types are sensitive to different impacts on different demographic processes, and different poor dispersers and good dispersers are also sensitive to different perturbations in the demography. Okay, and the final question is which agent is most likely to be sufficiently abundant to cause the sort of damage that we require to have the impact that we're after. Climate is of course an overriding factor, and it influences the abiotic and biotic interactions that determine a species distribution and abundance. There's a range of climate modelling approaches that can describe climate suitability through space, and also it can describe climate suitability through time. So in this example, it's highly suitable in the 1980s, but in the 1970s in a particular site, climate wasn't suitable. One of the findings we've taken from this is that you actually need very, very good either native range or experimental data to come up with models that are suitably accurate to be useful. Another way to look at this question of whether a species will become abundant at the right time is to use post-release evaluation to draw lessons from. And this is an example of a seed feeder that was reduced in Australia, released in Australia. Egg density against seed predation rate, of course, is a very strong relationship. But as parasitism increases, you need a lot more eggs, of course, egg density to obtain the same amount of seed predation. And typically you need 80% consumption to have population level impacts. So we say that there's 8 eggs per seed required without egg predation, egg parasitism, and much greater if there is egg parasitism. And the interesting thing about this example is that it's predictable. So with a new seed feeder, you could come up with this sort of relationship and make a prediction on whether a species is likely to, what the density requirements of a species is in its native range. And one of the findings, a take-home point from this is that univoltine insects are unlikely to cause the high seed predation levels required if seed availability through time is highly variable. So how do we, this is the final slide. So what should we draw from this, and how do we know that we're making progress in this agent selection? It's something that I think all biocontrol practitioners have been working towards through the history of our discipline. I think it's probably most useful to look at incremental steps of performance criteria. So looking for evidence that is becoming a more predictive science, look at incremental gains in our understandings and principles and generalisations. It'd be great to see more a priori predictions in the print, where we go and put ourselves on the line. In existing biocontrol programs, some evidence of us becoming more predictive is when we're actually putting our programs on the line and saying, no, we're not releasing that agent because we don't think it's effective, rather than just releasing it and sucking in C. And ultimately, hopefully, we can see improved success rates. So with that, I've got a special issue here where some of these ideas are in there. It's a compilation of various authors. Contact me if you want some more copies. And I'd also like to thank the organising committee for inviting me over. So thanks very much.